Like I said, my name is George. I'm an alcoholic. It's very important to me to my sobriety date. It's only for the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous and you people. It hasn't been necessary for me to pick up a drink since December 28, 1966, one day at a time. I believe, come like a sober in New York, they used to have a saying in New York that speakers speak and leaders lead. So I'm going to give you my first speaker, John.
I thought I was last on the list. Good morning, everyone. My name is John, and I am an alcoholic. My home group is the Loop Group in Palm City, Florida. We're the town that got hit by two hurricanes last year. But please feel free to come visit us. We'd love to have you down there. I'd like to say I'm not nervous, but I'd be lying. And since this is a meeting on forgiveness, which has something to do with honesty, I'll tell you that I am just slightly nervous. Thank God it's not filled. There's only a couple of 100,000 people here. I was so impressed with our speakers last night in that ceremony. This is my first international conference of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just was just mesmerized last night. It was such an exciting event. Oh, Lord. I'm going to start by just saying something that just happened to me. When I was growing up, my brother was 4 years older, and he got me interested in substance abuse, and he was much more advanced than I was. And I've loved alcohol since day one. I was born and raised in the South. You have two Southern speakers here, by the way. Some people don't consider Florida the South, but my family's lived in Florida since 1780. I'm actually a seventh-generation Floridian. And in North Florida, we consider ourselves still part of the South, so technically two of your speakers are from the South. And I used to think that I had my first drunk when I was in sixth grade, but actually, in the South, if you get a cold, my parents used to stir a little bit of bourbon and honey and lemon juice, and I'd knock it back when I was 4 or 5. So technically, I was doing shooters when I was, like, really young. But just before this started, a gentleman came up to me, Pryor, and I have not seen Pryor in probably 10 or 15 years. He took me to my first Alcoholics Anonymous conference probably 20 years ago. It was a Bob and Charlie Big Book seminar. And Pryor and my brother were roommates back when I was about 16. And I used to go over there, and I could drink beer and smoke pot with abandon, reckless abandon. And so it was really nice to see him here, and I got goosebumps. And he brought greetings from a friend of mine who I grew up with, went to high school with, and who is also now a proud member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our talk today is on forgiveness, start with forgiveness. And my sponsor, Giff, who celebrated 40 years of sobriety a couple of months ago, and has written a small book on the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, told me in the beginning that this whole program is about forgiveness. He said the purpose of the steps is to learn how to forgive ourselves, learn how to forgive others, and in that process we learn to be forgiven. And he said that the most powerful part of my story is that message of forgiveness. And so he told me to never forget that part of my story. I'm not going to talk much about my drunkologue other than to say that I am definitely an alcoholic. I am one of those people who was fascinated with alcohol from the beginning. I looked at it as a rite of passage. I looked at it as I would become an adult when I could drink. And I did a lot of other substances. I mean, goodness gracious, I grew up in South Florida in the 70s and 80s. And I knew people with speedboats. And when we were going to the Bahamas, every once in a while we'd find what we called square grouper, which were, well, I guess everyone here pretty much knows what they were. They were usually waterlogged, but they worked once you dried them out and smoked them. But So I did a little bit of everything, but I always loved and was fascinated with alcohol from the beginning. And I began my drinking in sixth grade and didn't stop again until I was 26 years old. I drank my way out of the University of Florida, which, that's a challenge. I joined a fraternity because it had a beer machine on the ground floor that you put a quarter in and pulled out a long neck bottle of beer. We had the best grower of marijuana in Micanopy, Florida. He was a horticulture major at the University of Florida. And those were good reasons to join, as far as I was concerned. I kind of came to after one semester and realized that I had missed every class for the entire semester. I bailed out. You know, my last semester I had a B and four incompletes. An incomplete was when you could talk the professor into believing that maybe there was some major problem, like, you know, I don't know. I'm sure I made up excuses. And I transferred to a small college in St. Augustine, where my father was on the board of trustees, and they had to take me. Suffice it to say, that was my first geographical cure. There were others, but I drank my way through life. I was a short, fat kid, and when I learned to drink, I became taller, cuter, funnier, more handsome. I could talk to the ladies. And that inside feeling that I always had of insecurity, doubt, fear, less than, better than, because I am an alcoholic. I'm an egomaniac trapped in an insecure body or with low self-esteem. And that alcohol, whenever I put it in, I became taller and cuter and funnier. And those feelings went away. I was fairly successful after I graduated from college. I had a good job in the restaurant business, which I will tell you is a great place for alcoholics. We get to drink on the job. It's part of it. So I excelled at it. I got a job running a yacht club in South Florida, and I was catering to some of the wealthiest people in the world, and I was 26 years old. And I had a car and a Labrador Retriever, and I felt taller and cuter and funnier. And everything looked good on the outside, but inside I was an alcoholic. I was scared. I was fearful. If you knew who I was, you would hate me. If you knew who I was, you'd love me. And that's who I was. And if I drank alcohol, I knew you loved me. I knew I was okay. In August of 1983, I went to the Florida Restaurant Association convention. I went there with a company credit card, a company car, and I was looking forward to having a wild weekend in Orlando. I drank my way into the, well, by the way, if you've never been to a restaurant convention and you're not sober, it is a wonderful place. All of the beer manufacturers, wine distributors are giving free samples, also known as shooters. I drank my way through there. And on Monday night, it was actually Sunday night, Monday morning at 2 a.m., I drove my car under a semi-truck. And that's the easy part of my story. That night, I ripped this side of my face off. I now have a glass eye. I fractured my hip. I was in intensive care for a week. And again, that's the easy part of my story. The hard part of my story to tell is that the girl in my car was killed. My blood alcohol was 0.22, and I was later convicted of manslaughter by an intoxicated motorist. And today it's still difficult to talk about. But that's part of my story in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's part of the story of forgiveness. And I want to tell you that I got sober that night and I never picked up another drink, but that's not the truth. I sat in the hospital for 6 weeks in traction, and when I got out, my jaw was wired shut, and I had one drink, and I didn't get drunk. But some of those fears went away, because now I'm this wonderful human being with this short and fat on the inside, scared, alone, lonely, and now I'm facing a manslaughter charge. I've killed another human being as a direct result of my alcoholism. Well, I had one drink and didn't get drunk. And as most of you know, because most of you are recovering alcoholics, at least I think you are, that's what the sign says on the front door, I had to drink. And I spent the next year and a half drinking and drugging away those feelings to the best of my ability. But the miracle happened during that period of time. My employer, who also happened to be my father, hired a woman to sell real estate for this development I worked at. And she proudly wore a circle and triangle around her neck. And she was a proud member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 5 years of sobriety. And that nasty woman would tell me her story. She never told me I was an alcoholic, but she shared with me her experience, strength, and hope. And she told me that she would wake up in strange places with strange men. And she would tell me that she woke up and she came to in the Virgin Islands and couldn't figure out how she got there, and it took her 2 years to figure out how to get back. But all I saw was this beautiful, attractive woman who was from a good family, selling real estate, and she brought by these people to drink coffee and sodas and iced tea by the gallon. They would sit at a table and laugh and share and cry, and they would leave, and I'd go, "Hey, Marilyn, that beautiful blonde, she's not one of you, is she?" And she goes, "Oh, yeah, she's got 10 years. So that one was off my list. But she introduced me to a lot of sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And another friend of mine, Bill E., got sober. It was after a party on his boat. I didn't see the fight, and I didn't see the police come because I had already passed out. But the next morning he got up, we parked his boat, and 2 days later he checked himself into a treatment center. And I watched him get sober. And I wanted what he had. I watched him lose that bloat, and I watched him, you know, get thinner, and he got a new car, and there were no roaches in it. And I mean the bug kind. For you people who grew up in the 70s and 80s. And I watched Alcoholics Anonymous work in his life. And then he did one of the meanest things an alcoholic can do to someone who's still out there. He took me to the Bahamas on his boat, and I took 3 cases of beer and 2 bottles of vodka for a 3-day trip, just in case we ran into an island of women and needed to have a party. And I would drink so as not to offend this recovering alcoholic. And that is a challenge, and it reminds me of alcoholism. You know, I'd drink one beer and then a soda. And on the last night, we were listening to a football game, and I'd say, "Bill, would you like another soda?" And he'd say, "Sure." And I'd run down below, and I'd knock back 2 or 3, and then I'd come up, and I'd sip one for an appropriate amount of time, 43 minutes or so. And then I'd go, "Would you like another soda?" And he'd go, "Oh, no, I'm fine." And I'd go down and knock back 2 or 3, and then sip one. But that's alcoholism. I was convicted in 1984, and soon thereafter I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Marilyn took me. Tommy and Chris were standing at the coffee pot. It was a Juno sponsorship group in Juno Beach, Florida. And I sat across from a guy named Harry H., and Harry had a gold Rolex, an Italian suit, a white Cadillac, a big building downtown, and I wanted what he had. I didn't pick up a white chip. I went to my obligatory meeting at Denny's afterwards, drank my coffee and ate my pie, and couldn't wait to get home and get drunk. But I left my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting with hope. I believe that y'all had the answer to my problem. I believe that y'all knew what was wrong with me, and if I could get what you had, I could be okay again. And so in February 26th of 1985, I checked myself into what I thought was a treatment center, a 28-day program. When I got there, it said long-term psychiatric hospital. I suggested I was in the wrong place. They suggested I wasn't. But I was so desperate, so tired, so suicidal, so fearful that I said, I'm going to give it a shot. And I checked in. And it was the best thing I ever did. During that period of time, I believe alcoholism kills a lot of people. And during that period of time, I was bouncing back and forth between maybe I could be a social drug user and drink successfully, or vice versa. And my friend Eric, who I had grown up with and who married the girl I went to prom with, he died of this disease. And the day I got that news, I knew that I was an alcoholic, and I surrendered fully because I knew this disease was going to kill me if I ever tried to pick up anything else again. And I began to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I began this program. I moved back to Palm Beach County. I jumped into AA. Like I said, Pryor took me to my first conference. It was a Joe and Charlie Big Book seminar. And I remember writing in my big book, seize this book as a drowning man would seize a life preserver. And I dove up. Someone's buying us breakfast, folks. Steak and eggs on the third floor. Thank you. I needed that, to be honest with you. So I dove into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I meant to start this speech by saying I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love everything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the people, the program, the steps, the books, the fellowship, the conference. I love everything about Alcoholics Anonymous because it's given me everything I ever wanted. It's given me peace of mind, security, dignity, and everything else. And it's given it to me by giving me the opportunity to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I met Giff after my sponsor Stuart moved out of town. And I'm happy and sad to say that Stuart then decided to be a social drinker, but now I sponsor Stuart. So be careful. Be careful how you treat your sponsor, because someday you might be his or her. But I went through that period of time where a lot of us go through where I was using the group as my sponsor, and everyone's my sponsor, and I don't really need a specific sponsor. And I was sitting with my brother, and he was drinking a Corona beer with a lime in it, and I went, wow, I've never had a beer with a lime in it. Maybe that would be interesting. And fortunately, Alcoholics Anonymous tugged at my ear and said, go to a meeting. And I went to a meeting, and Harry, the guy with the gold Rolex, and this guy, Giff, were sitting at that meeting, and I said, I need a sponsor. And I really assumed, because these guys were big AA guys, that they would assign me to one of their lower sponsees. And I've always said this imaginary coin went in the air and Giff lost, and he became my sponsor. And I am so grateful that my higher power did that for me, because Giff gently guided me into this program and guided me through the steps during a very difficult time of my sobriety. And at 3 years sober, I had to go back to court, and I had to sit with the family of the girl who was killed in my car. And by that time, I had 3 years of sobriety. I had been working the steps. I had been speaking to high schools and grade schools, telling them about drinking and driving. And I had been working in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And during this period of time, I wasn't allowed to meet with the family. But towards the end, things started to happen. I was sitting next to her father, and he was a NFL referee on the weekends and an executive on the weekdays, and he was a tough-looking guy. And I came off the witness stand, and he said, how are you doing? And I said, I've been better. And he said, we all have, but it'll be okay. And he said it to me in such a way that I didn't think he hated me, which is what I expected. I expected this family to hate me for the rest of my life because I had killed their daughter. You know, and what I had put their family through and my family through, I don't want anyone in this room to ever do. It's the disease of alcoholism. It kills people. And one day I was walking down the steps, and her brother was walking up the steps, and I said hello, and he said hello, and he said it in such a way that I didn't think he hated me. And that was good. And when it was all over, I went up to them and I told them how deeply sorry I was for what had happened that night in 1983. And they said that they knew that, and that I had been forgiven. And they said it was okay, and to go home and keep doing what I was doing and get married and have a family and get on with my life. And I don't believe that would have happened if it hadn't been for y'all and the steps and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what forgiveness is all about. It was that day that I was forgiven, and it was that day that I felt forgiven. And it is very difficult for me today to hold resentments, except with my mother-in-law. No. I'm sorry, Roseanne, I had to throw that in. It is very, very difficult for me to hold resentments today, because if they could forgive me, how can I not forgive someone else for what they may have done to me? So I began to continue working this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it has given me a life beyond my wildest imagination. I have traveled in Alcoholics Anonymous. I married my wife, who is from Guatemala originally, and she speaks five languages, so we can travel to strange places. And I've been to AA meetings, and I was in an AA meeting in Argentina, and I shared that I was from Stuart, Florida, which is a small town on the East Coast. And this guy tapped me on the shoulder, and he says, "My name is Pedro, and I'm a member of the Juno Sponsorship Group. Have you ever heard of it?" And I'm, my God, that was my first AA meeting. What a small world Alcoholics Anonymous is. I am beginning to run out of steam because I'm still scared to death. But I want to share with you something that happened to me after 17 years of sobriety. My parents, who I love, and my mother has loved me unconditionally since the day I was born. My mother is not an alcoholic. My wife says she practices Al-Anon better than anyone she met. She's actually just a Southern lady with a just incredible personality and spirit. And my mother and father wanted me to get a pardon from the state of Florida for what I had done. Oh, and by the way, I did not go to prison for what I did. And I didn't go to prison for what I did because the family of the girl who was killed in my car asked the judge not to put me in jail. And in those days, judges could do that. Today, I go to jail for a minimum of 5 years because of mandatory sentencing. So for them, I am always grateful, because I had my suicide plan in mind if he had sentenced me to jail. But my mother and father wanted me to get a pardon, so I actually applied for a pardon. And at that time, there was a man who was very powerful in the state of Florida, and he was a personal friend. And I asked him to assist me in the matter. And he was, at that time, the head of the Florida State Education Commissioner. His name is Frank Brogan. He's a wonderful man. And Frank told me to go meet with this woman whose name I won't use. And I sat in this conference room, and I had to tell her why I was applying for this pardon. I was scared to death. I called my sponsee, Marty. I called my wife. And Marty and Rosanna said, "Just go do your thing." And I was sharing with her that I was this sober member of a 12-step program. And she says, "Are you a friend of Bill Wilson's?" And I said, "Yes." And we were in this huge conference room, you know, one of those big conference tables with fat chairs. And I said, "Yes, I am." And she goes, "Today's my fifth anniversary. Would you give me a hug?" And during the process, the whole thing almost exploded, almost blew up because of a technicality. And she caught it. She took it to a man who looked at this piece of paper, and he said, "Is this John Gonzalez from Stewart?" And she said, "Yes." He goes, "I know his father and his brother. He's a wonderful person. Of course we can fix this." And what Frank told me, Frank is now the head of Florida Atlantic University, and Frank said to me, and at the time he was lieutenant governor, he said, "John, the whole process of pardons are about forgiveness. Back in the king's day, if you offended the king, you were banished or put in prison. And when the king finally decided that you were a friend of the realm again, he would give you a pardon." And that's where this whole process started. So in 1999, I stood in front of the cabinet, I asked him for a pardon, and I was given a pardon. and it was the official forgiveness of the state of Florida. It doesn't mean I didn't kill that girl, and it doesn't mean that I, you know, it's all gone. But what it does mean is that I've done the right thing for all these years, and that now I've done my service to the state, and I am officially forgiven. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It gave me that. I am grateful to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so grateful for all the people who have come to listen to me and that are friends and family to me. I believe that alcoholism kills people. And if you're sitting in this room today, you never have to pick up another drink, and you never have to kill someone, and you can live a happy, successful life if you begin working the steps of this program. I've had wonderful sponsorship, Bill and Dale and Giff, and I give them all of what I have inside as a direct result of what they've given me. I have to mention one person, Frances, who's sitting in the front row. Frances spoke yesterday, and the only reason I'm mentioning it to her is because I'm still an egomaniac. She promised that she would mention me yesterday, and she didn't. Therefore, I'm getting even. She is one of the women in Alcoholics Anonymous who has not only given so much to AA through her service and her commitment to the women of Alcoholics Anonymous, but she has been a gentle and loving influence in my life, and I just want to say thank you, because I know she doesn't know what she has really done for me as an alcoholic. I want to thank all of you for asking me to be here. I want to thank the General Service Board for asking me to be here, and I want to ask all of you to have a great conference and continue to work this program. Thank you.
That was wonderful. Thank you, John. Without any further ado, I'm going to give you my next speaker, a gal that I met a few years back in North Carolina, and I love Kathy so much. Kathy.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Kathy. I kind of got a little nervous when John looked over at me when he said Southern Lady, because I want y'all to know that I am a redneck woman. And everything I got on is from Walmart, including my glasses. And we still look pretty good, huh? And another thing is that we planned on you sitting up there. Katie and I did, so you would, you know, go first. Anyway, I still got a little con left in me. I tell you what, I'm just really overwhelmed by this weekend. The people I've met, new friends I've met, and people I've met coming up here, and just the different meetings, and I've noticed one thing is that we may speak different languages, we may look different, we may have that different dialect, but we all speak one language, and that's the language of the heart. And that's what y'all got me with, is the language of the heart. The only way that I know to do this is tell you an experience with forgiveness. And it's not in me forgiving, in somebody forgiving me, it's in me forgiving somebody else. My sobriety date is April 28th of 2000. It's not my first, but I pray to God that it's my last. My home group is the Belmont Group in Belmont, North Carolina. I have a sponsor today. And I'm just really overwhelmed by the life that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, because I had to say the prayers of being willing to be willing to be willing to do whatever you said do, because sometimes I wasn't willing. When I got back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I got this little old lady as a sponsor, and her name was Mary Nell, and I'll be forever grateful for her giving me the love that she gave me. And this is a story about my mother. You know, when I started doing my fourth and fifth step, a lot of it was on my mother. Because growing up, I really had a hard time with her. My dad was, was born July 7th, 1962, and to a family, my father was pretty stout and drinking, and he loved Jack Daniels and Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, and I grew to love that too. My mother never, she tried to drink every now and then and really couldn't. You know, my dad was never a violent drunk. He was always really quiet when he was not drinking, and then when he drank, he was really funny and paid attention to the kids, and I really loved that. I loved everything about my dad. I loved everything about alcohol. I loved the way it smelled, the way it tasted, everything about it. And just the way my dad was when he drank, I really liked that. And my mom always nagged my dad. And, I mean, just every time we turned around, she was always, you know, Daddy was doing something wrong. And I had a lot of resentment for many years because we never had anything. You know, I grew up with high water pants before high waters were popular. And no shoestrings in your shoes before that became popular. And never really had big Christmases or did piano lessons or any of that other stuff that I thought I was supposed to be able to do. Anything that I say up here, you know, it's not blaming. But I always did blame my mother for the way that I turned out and the way that things happened. I was very quiet when I was young. I didn't like being around people. I didn't like being around yelling because that's what my mother always did was yell. She had five kids. She had to yell. We didn't listen to her, you know. When I started drinking really early, I can remember stealing like Jack Daniels and the Pabst Blue Ribbon beer from my dad I really loved the way alcohol made me feel. The first time I ever got drunk, I was about 13 years old and went to a friend of mine's. A friend got married, and we went to her wedding reception in a drunk trailer park. We got a bunch of drunk trailer parks down there in the South, y'all. I think Northerners call them manufactured homes or something, but they're trailers. But anyway, we started drinking that Pabst Blue Ribbon, and I don't remember a whole lot about that night, but I do remember the next day when I went to school how Janet was telling everybody how funny I was, and my friend was telling people that. And I don't know about y'all, but when the Big Book talks about we become dangerously antisocial when we were drinking, that kind of was the opposite for me, because when I started drinking, I became dangerously social. I was very much a rebeller. I rebelled at every a bit of authority there was. Mom would say something or anybody would say something, and I'd go the opposite way. Hit the streets when I was 14 years old. At 15, I was in a nut house. At 16, I was in a treatment center. And 17, I was in a little juvenile prison. And in all that time period, I was running away, and every time I would come back to the house, I would be stealing something from Mama or doing something. Or I can remember at about 15 years old, before they put me in this nut house, I had stole some money from my mother, and she took a warrant out on me, and was standing across the hall from her, and I was in my handcuffs looking at her with all of the disgust that I could muster up because I just hated her so much. And she was standing over there crying. Today that blows me away how I could have done that for her. But anyway, many times like that, I would just stay gone for a year and never call except at 3 o'clock in the morning, and always asking for something, you know, never giving, always taking. I found that, from the time I was 17 up until about 27 years old, when I got out of that little juvenile prison, I found the beer joint. You know, it's where we had the Penrose sausages and then pink pickled eggs up there on the bar. And you went in there and, you know, they locked the doors at midnight and there was 20 of you in there and you didn't come out till daylight. And I loved everything about it. I love those bars. And that's pretty much where I stayed, in the bars and on the streets. And I would call every now and then, and Mama would be crying, talking about how much she'd been worried about me and where have I been. And I went home one day. I hadn't talked to her about nine months to a year. And when I pulled up in the yard, she come running out and punched me dead in the nose. She was supposed to go the next day and identify a Jane Doe that would fit the description of her daughter. So for 3 days, she thought I was laying in a morgue. And we don't think we hurt other people. And for a long time, I had that total resentment against my mother, thinking that if she had done better, then I wouldn't have been who I was. If I'd have had a different family, then I wouldn't be where I am. And when I found Alcoholics Anonymous the first time, it was back in 1989, and I walked into a group of men sit on one side and women sit on the other, and of course I had to sit on the men's side, but it wasn't long till the women grabbed a hold of me, and I'll be forever grateful for those women grabbing a hold of me, because I truly believe when a girl from the street comes in, what we need is love, not sex, and I'll be forever grateful for that lady. But anyway, they taught me the most, after coming back, I had 9 years of sobriety and went back out, and I'm not going to waste a whole lot of time on this, but I heard a lot of people when I come back said, you need to forget about that 9 years that you had, and because it didn't work for you. And I'm here to tell you that's not true. Alcoholics Anonymous has always worked for me. It was I who didn't do what I was supposed to be doing. I truly believe that it's because I didn't follow that spiritual, that I didn't enlarge on my spiritual life. That's why I went back out. And in that 9 years, I tried to have a little relationship with my mother, but it was very hard being around her. Every time I'd go around her, I'd make her cry. She's a little old country woman, did not like being around people, and it was just real hard. I'll tell you, she went blind when she was 36, and I used that too. And I've called her all kinds of names. And then when I got back to Alcoholics Anonymous after a year and a half of total torment, and it doesn't get any better. It doesn't get any better. But the sponsor that I got when I came back, Mary Nell, she would tell me, we started working on the fourth and fifth step, and my mom came up a lot, and she said, you need to just really work on your mom. And I said, but Mary Nell, I can't stand to be around her. Every time I can't stand to be there 5 minutes. And she said, I don't care. You're going to act as though you're a kind and loving daughter. And I said, but what about all this other stuff? I don't care if you can't forgive her. You're going to act as though you forgive her. And I would go to my mama's house, and I'd be there 5 minutes, and I want to go, God Almighty, I want to go so bad. And I would hear Mary Nell's voice in my head said, stay there, be there 30 minutes. That's all you got to stay, 30 minutes, and try not to make her cry. And I would go for a year, and be there just a little bit of time. And then I moved down near where she was, started working near where she lived. So I was with her every week, and I would call Mary Nell, and I thought, I cannot take it anymore. And she said, honey, she said, it's not about her changing. It's not about her attitude. It's about your attitude. She said, I want you to go to your mom's. I don't want you to say anything to her. I want you to just listen to her. Try not to run her life. Just listen to her. And I got to where I could go to my mom's house, and 2 months passed, and I hadn't made her cry. And 6 months passed, and she started telling me a little bit about her life, and I realized how she grew up. And she never had love from her mother or any of her family. And there was never any money in the house for her to give us the things that she wanted to give us, and that she was real sorry that she couldn't give me all the things that that she wanted to give me. And, probably a year went by, and my mom grabbed a hold of me and put my head on her shoulder and told me how much she loved me. Now, when I was 15 years old, my mom stood across me with all the disgust in her face and looked at me and said, you've got the pure devil in you. From all of the crap that I had put her through. And last week when I called her on the phone before my husband and I started on vacation, she called me an angel, that I was the angel in her life. My mother hasn't changed. It was through taking the actions that she told me to take when I didn't believe it was going to work. And it did work. It worked. All I had to do was be willing to take the action. Even when I didn't want to, just take the action. And today, because of what you people taught me and what you people gave me, my mother thinks I'm the greatest thing that ever walked on earth. You know, and and I told her also, I said, Mama, there's only 18 inches between the halo and the noose. And, of course, she didn't get it. But you've taught me how to be a kind and loving daughter. You've taught me how to be a kind and loving friend. And when I think about start by forgiving, it doesn't just include my family. It includes people I see on a regular basis in my home group who judge others. Today I'm trying to learn how not to judge those who judge others. And that's a big lesson for me. It's been really hard. Because I know, you know, we all weren't taught the same way, and I'm just realizing that. All I know is my responsibility to pass on what was passed to me in the way that it was given to me. And I'll be forever grateful that I fell in the loving arms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.
Well, I'll give you my next speaker, Katie.
Wow. Good morning, everyone. My name is Kate, and I am an alcoholic. And Kathy just told my story, so I can sit down now. I'm one of five children. My mother is a Southern Belle. But I am not your Southern speaker this morning. I'm your Northern speaker. And I'm not from New York, but I grew up very close to New York. I grew up in Newark, New Jersey. Thank you. And I survived. And Newark survived. It's still there. Oh, my home group is the Wantage Big Book Meeting Saturday night in Wantage, New Jersey, which is in Sussex County. Hey, hi. And it is the best home group in the entire world. And if you don't believe me, come and join us. Please come about 50 at a time because the room isn't this big. I was told early in sobriety that if your home group is not the best home group in the world, then you better go out and find one that is. And I was very fortunate early in sobriety. This group started when I was 90 days sober, and I've been there ever since. And I think it started for me because I really needed to read the big book. And the only way I was ever going to pick up that book was to go to a meeting once a week. And it was very, very helpful for me. Wow. Forgiveness. I told several people before I came here that I had been given this topic, and they said, oh, what topic is that? And I said, start by forgiving. And they laughed out loud in my face. And I thought, wow, you know, there is no coincidence in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really, really needed to practice this principle of forgiving. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous a very angry, angry woman. I hated everyone, and I think everyone just about hated me because I was not a nice person. I was out there on the streets for a very long time, and to be on the streets for a long time, you had to be for yourself. You had to do for yourself. You had to lie, cheat, and steal, and you had to con people, and that's exactly what I did. I did everything and anything in my power to survive on my own devices. I left home when I was very, very young. I was 16 years old. And I look at 16-year-olds today and I say, how the heck did I ever do it? You know, I thought I was the most mature person in the entire world. And boy, oh boy, I look at the 16-year-olds today and I'm like, wow, are they little, you know? They're young, they're immature, and they're snotty. And that was me. It was like looking in a mirror every time. And God has been really good to me, put a lot of young people in my life so that I could remember where I came from. And I came in the back door through Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in through another 12-step program. Well, a couple 12-step programs. I came in through Al-Anon for my first husband. And I came in through ACOA for my mother. And I was in ACOA for quite a few months. And it was towards the end of my drinking. It was in November of 1988. I got a phone call. I was at work that my nephew had killed himself. And as a direct result of this disease. And I immediately processed this through a drunken haze of it was my mother's fault. Because my mother was cruel, and my mother was cruel to my brother, and my brother was cruel to my nephew killed himself. So it was her fault. And so I went into these meetings, and I cried the blues about how horrible my life was, and how mean my mother was, and how I couldn't stand her, and how everyone, no one understood me, and, you know, my bosses were cruel, and my friends were cruel, and... You know, poor Kate, poor Kate, poor Kate, another drink, you know, and that's exactly where I was. And I would go to these meetings late and I would leave right before the Lord's Prayer because I couldn't get away quick enough. I just wanted someone to listen to me. I didn't want to listen to you. I didn't want to listen to your 12 steps. I didn't want to hear your program. And I really didn't want to get better. I just wanted you to feel sorry for me. So one day I'm walking out of... this meeting, and this guy, this great big guy, puts his arm out and wouldn't let me pass, and boy, I was angry. And I said, what are you doing? And he said, I just have to tell you something. He says, until you start working on yourself, you're never, ever going to get better. And I looked at him, and with all the disgust, I love that word, disgust I could muster up, I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, until you work on your alcoholism, you will never get better. And you know, that was the first time anyone ever called me an alcoholic to my face. I could not believe my ears. And I told him, I said, I am not an alcoholic. And I ran away. My father was an alcoholic. My brothers were alcoholics. My aunts, uncles, cousins, nieces, nephews, everyone in my family was an alcoholic but me. I was the angel in the family. You know, I got away with it. You people were stupid. You just didn't know how to drink. I knew how to drink. I knew how to drink because as soon as you caught on to me, I ran. I ran and got a new set of friends. I ran and got a new job. I ran and got a new family. I didn't want to be around people that really knew me because I couldn't let anyone know who I was. If you knew who I was, you wouldn't like me because I was not a likable person. I didn't even like myself. So this guy, you know, he planted a seed. And I never realized it at that time, but that's what he did. He planted a seed. And, you know, it wasn't the first time a seed had been planted. My brothers were sober 11 and 12 years, respectively, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And they had planted seeds by inviting me to their celebrations. Would you come and support me, they would say. And I would go and support them. And I wouldn't listen, but I would support them, and I'd feel like, oh, I'm the best sister in the world. I'm going to support my brothers. They have problems. And they would invite me to these sober picnics. My one brother had this sponsor. His name was Humble Bill. If you're from New Jersey, you know Humble Bill. And this man was cruel. He was not humble at all. He had not one humble bone in his body. But he called himself Humble Bill. And I hated him. They used to have these picnics up where I used to live. And Humble would say, let's go get your sister. And they'd show up at my house on a Saturday morning, and I'd really be under the covers with my head as big as the house and blurry-eyed and as sick as could be. And he'd say, come on, we're taking you to a picnic. And I'd say, no, I'm not going to any picnic with you. And he'd say, no, you're coming to this picnic with us. And I just knew he had something up his sleeve. And it was this stupid, sober picnic. You people didn't drink. There was nothing else there that I could do but sit around and listen to your problems, feel sorry for you, and tell you how wonderful I was and that I didn't have your disease. And I know that somewhere up there, Humble saw me get sober. He died shortly before I got sober, and I was sorry for that, you know. But he planted a seed. He planted a seed. No one ever told me I was a drunk. My family never told me. He never told me. You know, this guy in ACOA told me. But, you know, I listened to these people. All of a sudden, I started listening because the seed was planted. And I started hearing people in this 12-step program I was going to that they would say things like, in this other 12-step program I'm in. And I'm like, well, what do you mean, this other 12-step program? So one day when I was good and ready and tired and sick and really, really beaten down, and I had nowhere else to go, and I didn't know what I was going to do. All I wanted to do was kill myself. You know, I commute every day. At that time, I was commuting 53 miles one way. And like every morning I'd get in my car and I'd drive down the highway in a rage, and I would go after people in my car. I would go after them. Don't cut me off because I'm angry. You don't know who you're messing with. And all I'd want to do is hit the guardrail, and I would think about that. I'd think, well, all I want to do is hit the guardrail. And I want to finish this because I can't stand the pain anymore, and I don't know how to make the pain go away. And but my nephew had done that. And I thought, well, I couldn't do that to my family. You know, one of us doing it was enough. It was extremely painful. And no matter how much I didn't say, how much I said I didn't like them, I really did love my family. Because in the end, any time I was in trouble, whether it was financial or any other types of trouble, my family was always there for me, no matter what. No matter how much I said, oh, they hate me, they would always come to my rescue. And finally this big guy in ACOA was walking out the door one day after the meeting on Saturday morning, and I put my arm out. And he said, what is it? And I said, what's this other 12-step program you keep talking about? And he said, why don't you come with me? And upstairs, there was an AA meeting, ACOA in the ground floor, AA upstairs. And I was so fortunate to have that person in my life because he took me by the hand and he took me to my first AA meeting for me. And I went there and I didn't hear a word anyone said. I don't remember drinking coffee. I don't remember anything. I remember that he took me there and I couldn't get away from you people fast enough. I didn't want to hear what you said. But shortly thereafter, I went to a second meeting, and then I went to a third meeting, and then I became an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My first step in Alcoholics Anonymous was 13, and I worked the 13th step very well for the first 4 years of sobriety. And my sponsor at that time made me promise. This woman was relentless. She would do crazy things like make me promise things to her. All right, look, if this doesn't work out, I want you to make me a promise. And I said, I'm not making any promises I can't keep. No, you have to promise me. And she would stay on me and stay on me like a bug on my back. And she wouldn't let go until I would make this promise that I figured I would never, ever keep. And the one thing she made me promise is that if this relationship ended, I would become a newcomer all over again. I would never relationship for a year. I would follow suggestions. I would go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I would read the big book. I would pray, and I would follow the steps, work the steps, starting with number one. And I said, oh, yeah, okay, I can make that promise because this relationship is it. This will never end. I'm in love. Well, 4 years later, I wasn't in love anymore, and he wasn't either. And I have to say, it's only by the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous that I did not drink over that relationship. And I hated my sponsor for making me make that promise, because one thing that I had learned is that I have to follow the promises. And not only the promises of Alcoholics Anonymous, but promises I make to people. I have to be honest and true to myself. So I didn't have a relationship. It was actually 2 years. And I worked my program to the best of my ability. I all of a sudden became friends with women. This was something new in my life. And the women, when this relationship ended, swarmed around me, and they helped me. They helped me learn how to take care of myself. It was the first time in my entire life, from the age of 16 all the way up to 36, 40 years old, that I had my own apartment. I had my my own job. I was taking care of myself. I didn't have a man to help me hang curtains. I did it myself. Called my girlfriends up. They came over. We hung them together. They were crooked, but they were up, and they didn't fall down. And I was happy. I was really, really happy. I got involved in service, general service work, and I put both feet in AA. I stopped being an alkanaut, and I became an alcoholic person in sobriety, in recovery. And I started carrying the message. And by doing this, people started coming to me. It was an incredible experience. No one ever came to me before. I was a hateful person, and I hated myself. And when I started working the steps, and I got up to steps 4 and 5, someone in a meeting once said, you have to start by forgiving yourself. And I thought, that's a bunch of junk. You know, when I started forgiving myself the day I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. But you know something? I didn't, because I was still calling myself names. I was still chastising myself for things that I had done. And it wasn't, I have to continue to forgive myself. I'm forgiving myself all the time. You know, it's, I had to work really hard on my anger when I came into AA, because I was really angry. I thought that I had been, you know, really cheated in life. But I hadn't. It was just a journey. It was a journey that I had to go through to get to where I am today, and I know that. When I wrote my fourth step, my fourth step was all on what everyone else did to me. My sponsor told me to make a column in how it made me feel and what my part in that was in each situation that I wrote down. And then we sat down and did a fifth step. And after the first couple hours of talking to her about my poor life, I finally realized that there was a pattern here. I did the same things over and over and over again, and nothing ever changed in my life. And once I started talking about it, I got really tired of hearing myself talk about my problems, and I believe that that's when my spiritual experience happened. In my fourth step, I didn't feel any wonderful, you know, I don't know. I didn't see any burning bushes, hear any bells, didn't see any angels flying over. But you know what I felt? I felt like I'm finally growing up, finally becoming a useful member of society like I always wanted to be, and finally becoming a likable person. It wasn't always easy, though. In early sobriety, I worked in this job. I was 2 years, I had been on the job 2 years when I got sober. And I stayed there for another 10 years. And in those 10 years, I still wasn't forgiven by half the people in that company. And the problem is, I don't remember half the things I ever did to any of those people. So it was hard to say I was sorry. I had to really do it by example, by living a good, clean life, by not repeating whatever I had done in the past. And, not that I knew what I had done, but just because I knew how I was, it didn't necessarily mean that I remembered what I did to any particular person, but I just had to be a good person from then on and not mistreat people. And when I did mistreat people, thank God for the 10th step. Thank God, because I practiced that in early sobriety a lot. I learned that, from my 8th step, making that list of the people I had harmed, boy, that was a long, long list by the time I got there. From someone who came into AA and said, I never hurt anyone in my life, everyone hurt me, to making a resentment list and then making an amends list, it was an incredible experience for me. I made this list, and then I had to go out and find the people. And I had a lot of excuses not to do that, They moved away. I haven't seen them in 20 years. I don't know where they are. They don't want to see me. I had all the excuses in the world. Some of them died. I used all the excuses, but I was actually willing to, if I ran into someone, to make an amends. And my sponsor told me that wasn't good enough. I had to do the footwork in order to really feel the full benefits of forgiveness. So I went out and I found a lot of people that I had harmed, and I asked forgiveness. And, a lot of people didn't forgive me. A lot of people did, but, the one person that I asked forgiveness from was someone in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that person chose not to forgive me. That was my first devastating experience with the 9th step, is wronging someone in AA and actually honestly feeling that I was sorry, but not being forgiven by that person. I don't know where that person is today because she's moved on in her life. But anyway, but I was told by my sponsor that they didn't have to forgive me back, that I just had to clean my side of the street and make sure that I wasn't using, I'm cleaning my side of the street as an excuse to continue with my bad behavior. So today, I live my life the best that I can. I do service as often and as much as I can. I have love in my life. I have a lot of love in my life. I have friends in my life. I have people who actually care about me. If they don't hear from me, they call me. I don't have to, if I'm isolating, they find me. I have been forgiven by a lot of people. My family is in my life today. My family is very active. You have to be careful what you pray for, people. I'm telling you, because I prayed that I would get my family back in my life. I moved 50 miles away from my family when I was 16 years old, and 10 years ago, they all moved up by me. And it was a blessing, and it still is. Even though I complain and I moan about it at times, you know what? They're there, they're close, and I feel their love. And I love what Kathy was sharing about having a relationship with someone but not on their terms, like accepting them for who they are and you doing the changing. And I've had to do that with my family, I've had to be the one to make the changes and to love them for who they are and the way they are and to have the type of relationship that I'm capable of having with them. And it's worked. It's worked one day at a time. It hasn't been easy. This program is not, it hasn't been simple for me. It just hasn't been easy. But I keep putting one foot in front of the other. I haven't had to take a drink in a long time. And hopefully I won't ever have to take a drink again if I keep coming here and doing what you people tell me to do. Thank you very much.
great to start the morning off. This was absolutely wonderful. I want to thank John, Katie, and Kathy for sharing the strength, hope, and experience. Give them another hand. And we have a wonderful way of closing. Close with the Lord's Prayer.